Thank you for taking the time to listen to our weekly service. This is a listener-supported ministry, and we ask that you pray and see what God would have you give. Now let's get to our sermon for today.
Well, you remember what I said last time about me putting a clock up here. You remember what that? Remember what that means? Remember what it means? Remember what it means? Nothing. It means nothing when I put this up here. Well, good morning. How are y'all doing? We brought my mother, Betty Carper. I came to Christ in Yokohama, Japan, International Baptist Church, 1964. So I'll say good morning to you guys, except to Gary, I'll say Ohayou gozaimasu.
He says sorry.
So good morning. We're continuing on with our study of Nehemiah as a leader. And as I mentioned to you before, most of us don't think of ourselves as leaders. We just think of ourselves as regular people. Well, actually, in most cases, all of us are a leader to somebody, because what is a leader? A leader is somebody who has somebody behind you. Could be a friend, could be your own kids, could be coworkers, people who look up to you, they want to emulate you, they know that you have something that they don't have, and so they're following you. Well, the first message in this series was about using God as our example of a leader, and how he had a plan and he was working toward that plan, and nothing could stop it, even to the point where he was using people who were not his own children. Talked about how in the book of Isaiah, under the inspiration of God, prophesied that the Jews would be taken away from their homeland. They would be subjugated, and then after a while, they would be allowed back in, and they would build the temple again. And do you remember what the name of the king was who God said in Isaiah, "Do you know my servant?" Do you remember his name? That was Cyrus. He said, "Do you know my servant Cyrus?" Well, this was predicted 150 years before Cyrus was born. This is what leads, by the way, the atheists, or I shouldn't say atheists, modernists, to go back and say, well, of course the book of Isaiah was written after the fact. They make it look like a prophecy, but it isn't, because nothing could be that close to happening. You know, 150 years, naming a person's name. So obviously, you know, it was written after the fact, but they say it was written 150 years earlier. Well, Cyrus, you remember, read that in Isaiah the prophet's scrolls, and he's going, whoa, this is talking about me. Okay, you guys can go back to your homeland. Well, we read in Nehemiah chapter 1, that was the message that we had last time, was about how Nehemiah began on his knees. And how he claimed the promises of God. Do you remember how he went back and he was praying to God, and he was praying back the promises that God made Israel? He said, okay, now if you guys are bad, I'm going to disperse you. I'm going to have you taken over, but I won't forget you forever. I will bring you back. And if you humble yourselves and pray and turn from your wicked ways, then I'll hear from heaven. I'll heal your land. I'll restore you. And so he was claiming those promises, which I was glad that Fred chose the song Standing on the Promises. And when we were singing that, I was thinking of Nehemiah. I mean, think about it. If you were here last week, you remember Nehemiah's prayer in chapter 1 is almost consistently, you said, you said, you said. Now, you said that if we sin, you'd take us away, but if we repented, that you would bring us back. Now, Lord, we're repenting. I'm repenting for the whole nation. Bring us back. So he was standing on the promises. And here's the song. Standing on the promises of Christ my King, through eternal ages, let his praises ring. Glory in the highest, I will shout and sing. Standing on the promises of God. But the second verse, standing on the promises that cannot fail. Now, Nehemiah knew that those promises were by God and they couldn't fail, and he would stand by them. When the howling storms of doubt and fear assail, by the living word of God, I shall prevail, standing on the promises of God. And then the third, standing on the promises, I cannot fall. Listening every moment to the Spirit's call, resting in my Savior as my all in all, standing on the promises of God. And I thought, that's the story of Nehemiah right there. In chapter 1, it was all about how leaders begin on their knees. And so if we, So leaders then start off with prayer. But that what I'm trying to get to now in chapter 2 is about how leaders tend to be planners. They think ahead about things. I don't know if you remember. I certainly do as a kid. Do you remember getting those papers that had a maze on it? You know, and you're supposed to start at some point, and you got to take your pencil and follow it all the way to the end. Well, most of us, being the dumb kids that we were, we started at the beginning. You know, there's maybe four, five, or six entrances, and you started at one, and oop, got stuck, started at the other. Well, after a while, you kind of learn that the way to do those mazes is to do what? Start at the back. You know, start at the end and work backwards. Well, that's what planners do. That's what leaders do. They always begin with the end in mind. What is it that I'm trying to accomplish? And then I'm going to work backwards. And when you work backwards, a plan just kind of comes together. You know, oh, I'm going this way. Oh, that's where I should have started. Okay, everybody, we're going to start here, and then we're going to work toward the end. Leaders tend to be those people who are always thinking a little bit ahead of everybody else. I've heard the story about two business people. One tended to be a pretty good planner. The other one, not so much. They were out camping, and this is very reminiscent of my life. We were out camping one time. Dad was there, and we were chased by a bear. Well, anyway, these two business people, one a planner, one not, were being chased by a bear. And they are running like crazy away from that bear, and bears can run pretty fast. Yeah. Bears can run pretty fast. And the one guy who's behind the other guy as they're running, he said, "Hey, we can't outrun this bear." And he says, "I don't need to. All I need to do is outrun you." Okay? He is thinking with the end in mind. If I can outrun this guy, that's all there is to it. Okay, so leaders tend to be those who think ahead and plan. Second of all, leaders tend to be those who, once they come up with this plan, start preparing. They start thinking things through. They think through the steps of their plan. They're creating lists. They're thinking about it almost all the time. Okay, now I'm going to need the following stuff if I'm going to be doing that. You might have projects at home, that, like we were talking about this morning. We have projects at home. So even while you're out doing other things, you're thinking, okay, oh, I'm going to need such and such. Make a mental note or write it down. They tend to think of things ahead of time and be planning. I visited a friend of mine. He is the executive vice president for the largest property building, commercial property building and managing company in the world. It's called Heinz Corporation, not Heinz as in with a Z with a ketchup. This is H-I-N-E-S. They're located out of Houston, Texas. This guy is the EVP for all of the operations in, I believe it's Canada, in North America and South America, Mexico, Central America, all of that. And they build hotels, they build commercial buildings, skyscrapers, high-rises. And he told me that his company has a three-step process. The first step is find out what the customer wants. Now, Fred, you sometimes have to write programs. And that's the first thing you got to do is figure out what does the customer want. And sometimes they don't know what they want. They just kind of know what they want, but they can't say specifically. So you got to spend a lot of time just helping them figure out what is it that you're trying to do. That takes a long time. Second of all, you have to then come up with a plan of, okay, how are we going to build this thing? And then the third part is just to actually build it. The building process is actually the fastest part. Even though sometimes coding stuff takes a long time, that's fast. But the hardest part is to actually figure out what it is that they want and then plan it out. This guy, he was telling me that they have very, very few, if any, change orders in any of the buildings that they make. He was telling me about a Hilton hotel that they were building in a major metropolitan area, big Hilton hotel. And he said, we planned this thing down to the point where we even built mock-ups of particular types of rooms. You know, in a hotel, all the rooms are the same. You know, they have rooms with one bed, rooms with two beds, suites, you know, that kind of thing. Well, they built a mock-up of each type of room, complete in every detail. running water, all the fixtures, electrical outlets all worked, and then they had people live in them just to make sure that everything was as they needed it to be. They even had the customers go and live in it for a while. Oh man, that outlet is kind of hard to reach when you're over here trying to shave with an electric shaver. Okay, we need to... So they would spend months planning stuff out so that when they're done, the building process goes pretty quick. Very few change orders that they had to do. And the third thing is that leaders tend to be promoters. Once they've done their planning, once they've done their praying, and once they've done all of this, now they tend to promote it. You know, there are people that you know and that I know who they tend to be very winsome kind of people. They win you over all the time. You know, somebody asks, they'll come up to you and you'll ask them what they're doing, and they'll tell you something that they're working on, and you want to quit your job and go to work for them. Because they know what they're doing. They know the direction that they're going. And some of these people don't even realize that they're promoters. They're so excited about everything it is that they're doing that they just kind of win people over. Hey, can I come work for you? No, I don't have any room for you. But they just are promoting things. Well, Nehemiah was a planner, he was a preparer, and he was a promoter, and I did not, that I planned on an alliteration, the three P's. I didn't plan on that, the earlier message being he was a prayer. So he's a prayer, he's a planner, he's a preparer, and he's a promoter. That was Nehemiah. So let's take a look in Nehemiah chapter 1. Let's go back a little bit. It's kind of like a snowplow, you know, you plow ahead a little bit. Well, the way that I tend to go is I ended last week about here. Well, let's back up a little bit and get a running start and then get into chapter 2. But let's start with Nehemiah chapter 1. Now, Nehemiah chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, and then verse 11. Nehemiah 1, 1 through 4, and then 11. Now, it happened in the month of Chislu in the 20th year. Do you remember what month I told you Chislu was? November. Okay, it was November of, I think it was 445 BC. So in November of 445 BC, as I was in Susa, the citadel, or the palace. Now, remember, he worked for Artaxerxes. He was the cupbearer to the king. And this guy was the king of the most powerful empire, the Persian Empire, that the world ever knew. And these people were not nice people. These were kind of cruel people. And he is a servant to this king. That Hanani, one of my brothers, came with certain men from Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the exile. Because it was many years earlier, you remember that Cyrus read about himself, and he said, okay, God says that somebody named Cyrus, hello, that's me, is going to send them back to build their temple. So he went ahead and sent them back to build the temple. Well, they did. But many years have passed since that time. So here, Hanani meets with Nehemiah, and Nehemiah says, how's it going for our folks that are there building the temple and all? And Hanani, one of my brothers, came with certain men from Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the exile, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and the gates are destroyed by fire. As soon as I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. So he started off with prayer. Now, the prayer was, if you look in verse 11, O Lord, now again, with verse 11, this is the end of chapter 1. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant, and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name. And give success to your servant today. Give success? Wait a minute. Sounds like he must have something in mind. He has some kind of a plan going on in his head. And give success to your servant today and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. That is the king. Now, I was the cupbearer to the king. And as I talked about last time, he began with prayer. Now, keeping in mind that he was very familiar with the history of what was going on. This king's father was King Ahasuerus. King Ahasuerus was the king who fired his old queen and hired the new queen, Esther. And Esther was a Jew. And Esther saved her people from the cruel King Ahasuerus when she went to him and said, I'm pleading for my people. He said, your people? What people are you talking about? Well, I'm a Jew. Really? I didn't know that. Yeah, and this guy Haman over here, he's trying to get us all killed. And you made a proclamation because he told you to, that it's open season on all the Jews. Oh, man, I'm really sorry about that, but you remember the laws of the Medes and the Persians, you can't change the law. So Ahasuerus said, okay, I can't change that law. It is open season on the Jews, but I'll come up with another law. And the other law was, oh, and they can fight back and kill you and take your stuff if you attack them. And so then the people were saved because of that, and he then killed Haman, the king did. So Nehemiah is aware of that because that happened one generation before. And now he's in a position very similar to Esther, where he is now before the king, and he's thinking, okay, something's got to be done. So I see a couple of things here. I see, first of all, that Nehemiah wasn't just praying, oh, Lord, I pray that something is done. All right, and then he goes back to work. Pray that somebody does something. He was praying that something would be done and that it might be done through him. Oh Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name and give success to your servant today and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. So he was praying that something is going to be done and that it's done through him and his unique job. Nobody else has the ear of the king like he does. So he directly served, spoke to the king every single day, and this is the king of the most powerful empire on the planet. That would be like, you know, you're the person who pours the coffee for the president of the United States, and the president drinks a lot of coffee. And you're in a position to just drop a word here and there about things. And mostly, kings kind of like to hear what's going on in the kingdom. You know, they know that whatever they hear is being filtered through people who are trying to promote themselves. And he's not trying to promote himself. Now, last week, I talked about how there were some managers who really work hard. I mean, they're the type of people, they hear a problem, they immediately start planning it, they start working their plan, they're single-minded and all of that. Well, godly leaders are the same way, but they begin on their knees, they begin with prayer. I mentioned Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs, as far as we know, an unsaved man who ran Apple Computer Company. Well, Steve Jobs said, I don't even know what it is that drives me. He said, it's not like something is like buckshot racing at me in the back that I've got to run away from this stuff to be a manager. No. He said, it's like a pull that I can't control this thing. I've got to do this. I've got to make it better. I've got to make it faster. I've got to come up with these computers. I don't have a choice. That's just the way that I am. Well, he also said, one of the things that Steve Jobs would said oftentimes, he said, you know who the best managers are? And I'm thinking of somebody who is in this room that I talked to after the service last Sunday, who is not a manager. I won't mention her name because it's being recorded. But the best managers are those people who never really wanted to be managers. They didn't want to be in charge. They don't really care about being in charge. They don't want to be managers. They weren't seeking the job, but they knew that if they didn't do it, the job wouldn't get done. And so, okay, I'll be a manager. But they aren't the people who go and study how to be managers because that's their driving force in life. Now, I think that Nehemiah was a lot like this. Because when you read later, as we're eventually going to get to, you know, I've got a series where I'm going to be talking about every chapter in Nehemiah. And there's quite a few chapters, so eventually we'll get through it. Nehemiah is content, once his job is done, to just quit and go back and keep pouring coffee for the king. Okay? He didn't have a drive to go out and get this wall built and get Jerusalem secured and then become a king. He didn't want to do that. As soon as he was done, fine. He went back to his old job of being the cupbearer to the king. But let's go ahead and look at Nehemiah chapter 2. Beginning in verse 1, let's go ahead and read from Nehemiah 2:1 through verse 8. And then I'll make some comments as we go. In the month of Nisan, remember he started off, his brother came to him and talked to him in the month of Chislu. Well, in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, I took up the wine and I gave it to the king. Now, I had not been sad in his presence. And the king said to me, why is your face sad, seeing you're not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart. Then I was very much afraid. I said to the king, let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins, and its gates have been destroyed by fire? Then the king said to me, okay, what are you requesting? What do you want? So I prayed to the God of heaven. Now he started on his knees, and now he's not on his knees. He's serving the king, and he's going, oh man, the king is saying, okay, put up or shut up. So I prayed to the God of heaven. That's one of those real quick prayers when you find yourself in a position where I wasn't expecting this to happen. Okay, Lord, help me. And I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I might rebuild it. And the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, how long will you be gone? And when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time. And I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me to the governors of the province beyond the river. That, by the way, they talk about the provinces, and it's kind of in the far country. In the old-timey maps, it says, there be dragons, you know, over here. Well, that was kind of the Wild West, you know. Actually, in this case, I guess it was the Wild West, that area beyond the river. Give me letters to the governors in the provinces beyond the river, where it's kind of wild over there, that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple and for the wall of the city and for the house that I shall occupy. And the king granted me what I asked, for the good hand of my God was upon me. I mean, here the king says, boy, you're sad. What's going on? Okay, Lord, help. This is why I'm sad. And then he said, okay, well, what do you want? What can I do to fix this? And he said, okay, I need this and this and this and this and this. All right, fine. Great. There you go. Because the hand of his God, the good hand of his God, was upon him. So point number one of Nehemiah being a planner. Okay, I'm going to talk about him being a planner, a preparer, a little bit about being a promoter, but toward the end I'll talk a little bit about that. But Nehemiah is a planner. Point number one, Nehemiah was a planner, but he wasn't a manipulator. He had a plan in mind, obviously. Nobody comes up with this. I need this, I need this, I need this, and he says, when are you coming back? And he gave him a time. So he had been thinking about this for a long time. But he wasn't a manipulator. You know, he was waiting for God to open the door, but he was waiting on God's timing. He said in Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 11, O God, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name, and give success to your servant today. He had a plan in mind. And grant him mercy in the sight of this man. Now I was cupbearer to the king. Now back when Nehemiah first heard that there was a problem, he started praying about it. He had something going on in his mind that was like this. I have this huge burden. God laid that burden on him. God didn't lay that burden on other people. I mean, other people, when they said, well, how are things going on in Jerusalem? And they said, oh, man, walls are broken down, gates burned with fire, you know, people are a reproach. Oh, okay, I guess we need to pray for them. Not Nehemiah. I mean, it just hit him like a ton of bricks, and he went straight to his knees, and he was fasting and praying. Because as it says in Philippians chapter 2, verse 15, for it is God that worketh in you to will and to do of his good pleasure. God put it in the heart of Nehemiah to be just torn up by this. Nobody else was torn up by this like he was. And then to will and to do of his good pleasure. So here he is willing and he is praying and now he is doing. So I have this tremendous burden. I know that Jehovah promised to bring the children back to Jerusalem 70 years after they were taken captive. And you remember, Nehemiah really knew the scriptures. And what were the scriptures? If you don't have to turn there, but in Jeremiah 25, verses 10 through 12, where God says, moreover, I will banish them from the voice of mirth, this is the children of Israel, and from the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, the grinding of the millstones and the light of the lamp. This whole land shall become ruin and a waste, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Then after 70 years are completed, and the 70 years were completed when at this time when Nehemiah had this burden. Then after the 70 years are completed, I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, the land of the Chaldeans, for their iniquity, declares the Lord, making the land an everlasting waste. And then moving forward four chapters to Jeremiah 29, verses 10 through 14. For thus says the Lord, when the 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will visit you, and I will fulfill you my promise and bring you back to this place. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will hear you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord, and I will restore your fortunes and gather you from all the nations and all the places where I've driven you, declares the Lord. And I will bring you back to the place from whence I sent you into exile. I mean, you can't get much clearer than that. God says, I'm going to take you away. You're going to be punished. It's like you're going to the woodshed for 70 years. But after that 70 years, I promise you, I'm going to bring you back. Well, 70 years has now passed. And Nehemiah knew the scriptures, and he knew that this was year 70. I mean, he knew it. You just read his prayers, and he knows what the scripture says. He knows this is year 70. He knows that he is in front of the king. He knows now, at the there's a moment of truth. Boom, the king looks at him and says, you're sad. What's going on? And that's a sadness that God put in his heart. And then because of that, Nehemiah started doing some planning. Please, Lord, prosper me in the sight of this man. And then all of a sudden the opening happens. I'm not a football fan. We like baseball at our house. We're not real big on football. You know, you don't have to be an ex-con to play baseball. You know, it seems like you have to do that in football. But I played football in high school. Not very well, but, when you have the ball, you're constantly looking, and then all of a sudden, boom, a hole opens up. What do? You got to run through it. Well, here, Nehemiah is there before the king, serving him, and all of a sudden, a hole just opens up, and he's got the ball, and he says, I'm going for the goal line. Point number two, Nehemiah took time to plan. In Nehemiah 1:1, it says, now it happened in the month of Chislu, which was November, in the 20th year, as I was in Susa, the palace. So here it is, November. Well, in Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 1, it also mentions a month. In the month of Nisan, that is in around, I think that's in April of 443 BC, 444 BC, something like that. 4 to 5 months later, he's in the palace. So something was happening during that 4 to 5 month period in his mind. This guy, he's so burdened about it, and he's praying so hard about it that he's always thinking, okay, I'm in a special position. If something comes up, what would I do? All right. Well, obviously the walls are broken down. Gates are burned with fire. We'd need wood, wouldn't we? Well, where am I going to get that kind of wood? The only person who controls timber around here is the keeper of the forests for the king. Well, I would need to ask the king to give me a letter that says to the keeper of the forest, give that guy all the wood he needs. Okay, what else am I going to need? I'm going to need people to go along with me. Because if it's just me going back there trying to get all the people riled up, well, the people are going to, on the other side of the river, they're going to see me as being some kind of wandering bandit, and they're going to kill me. So I need some protection. And he does get that protection. And I'm also going to need letters from the king. So he's thinking through this thing. Until finally, when 4 to 5 months later, a door opens up, the hole opens, he's got the ball, and he sees the goal line, and he's going for it. The king says, okay, what are you making request for? Now, he didn't make a request. He just said, why are you sad? And he said, well, place of my ancestors' graves is desecrated. And, oh, well, what are you asking for? What can I do to help? The king could have just said, oh, yeah, that's really a sad story, and I'm sorry for you. He said, it's been exactly 70 years. I have the ear of the king. I think I'll work on a plan, but I'm still scared about it. So in verse 2 of chapter 2, and the king said to me, why is your face sad, seeing you're not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart. Then I was very much afraid. So it's clear that Nehemiah didn't plan to look sad. Sometimes if you want something, you kind of manipulate people. Fat boy, maybe he's kind of sulking or something. He goes home and he just kind of until finally Bubbles asks, "Okay, what's wrong?" "Nothing." You know, I don't know. You probably never do that. I do. And so that's the kind of manipulation that sometimes we do with people. Just waiting for somebody to say, "What's wrong?" Well, obviously he was not trying to manipulate, because it said, "And then I was very much afraid when the king noticed it, because you don't look sad in the king's presence." How come? Because if you look sad, kings only want happy people around them. And if you're not happy, well, I'll find somebody who is. So off with your head. You know, it's like the beatings will continue until the morale has improved. Right? So you don't do that with kings. So he wasn't sighing, and the king says, "What's wrong? You're sad." "Oh, nothing." You know, he wasn't manipulating. And the king said to me, "Why is your face sad, seeing you're not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart." Then I was very much afraid. It doesn't say he was afraid. It doesn't say he was much afraid. I was very much afraid. You know, it's like, be afraid. Be very afraid. Well, he was. Very much afraid. I would think that this is the same fear that Esther had when she was told that the king had just made a decree to wipe out all the Jews, and she's a Jew, and she was told by her uncle Mordecai, "Look, do you think that you're going to be spared in this? I don't think so. The Lord brought you to a kingdom for such a time as this. You need to go have a talk with him." And she was scared, and she said, "Okay, I'll do it. But if I go to the king and I'm unbidden, the king doesn't call to me and say, 'Hey, I got a question for you.' If I just walk into the throne room and he hasn't called me, he can either hold out a scepter and I can take a hold of it, which means he gives up to a third of his kingdom to me. So if anybody comes to the king unbidden, the king can either say, 'Kill that person,' or he can hold out a scepter and that person, that king, has to give that other person up to a third of his kingdom." Now, do you think the kings are more inclined to kill the person than give away a third of what they have? Yeah. So she was scared. But she said, "I'm going to do this, and if I die, I die." Well, now he is in this position. If I die, I die. Okay. He was very much afraid. Point number two, Nehemiah took that time to plan. That planning time was, again, 4 to 5 months. That was in late March, early April of 443 B.C. So for 5 months, he prayed, he fasted, and apparently he planned this stuff out. Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 2 through 6. Again, "And the king said to me, 'Why is your face sad, seeing you're not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart.'" Now, he wasn't planning on looking sad, and he may not have even looked sad. He may have looked perfectly okay. But God put it in the heart of the king to say he's sad. He may have not even been sad. He may have been grinning the whole time while he's pouring the wine for this king. But God puts it in the heart of the king: "This guy's sad. Why are you sad?" "It's nothing but sadness of heart. Then I was very much afraid. I said to the king, 'Let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins? Its gates have been destroyed by fire.' Then the king said to me, 'What are you requesting? What you want? What can I do for you?' So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, 'If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, send me to Judah, the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it.'" By the way, I'll talk to you in just a moment about how he chose his words very carefully. Because you say, "Well, man, it sounds kind of convoluted. Send me to the place of my father's graves," as opposed to, "I want to go to a particular town, you know, that I may be able to rebuild it." And the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, "How long will you be gone? When will you be return?" And it pleased the king to send me when I gave him a time. Point number three, as he took time to plan, he worked on the plan so long that it was firmly planted in his mind. I mean, this guy had it down. He didn't have a piece of paper. Some of us, when we go into a meeting, we will have note cards. We'll have our PowerPoint presentations. And we will be showing our presentation to the CEO of the company. Now, if we're doing this, then we will need... And we're looking at the points of the plan. He had it down so much, he knew everything. He had been thinking about it. He'd been praying about it. God had put it in his heart. "And I said to the king..." verses 5 through 8a. If it pleases the king, let letters be given to me, to the governors of the provinces beyond the river, that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah. Now, by the way, in your Bible, it may have the B in the word beyond capitalized and R capitalized, because this was a place, a name of a place, just like Greenville is spelled with a capital G because it's a place. Well, to them, beyond the river was a place. So give me letters to this, to the province beyond the river, that they let me, may let me pass through until I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple, and for the walls of the city, and for the house that I'll occupy. Point number 4. When successful, godly leaders always give credit to God. He didn't go home and say, "Whoa, I hit a home run," or "I saw that hole and I ran through it and I made the touchdown and I'm slamming down the football and yoo-hoo." Huh? What is the last thing that we see there at the end of verse 8? "And the king granted me according to the good hand of my God upon me." That he never took credit for himself. He gave the credit to God because God put the burden in him. God put the plan in his heart. He was praying that God's plan would be done. God moves in the heart of the king to see that the guy's sad. And then he moves in the heart of the king to say, "What would you like me to do?" And then he moves in the heart of the king to say, "Sure, I'll do anything you want." I mean, what do you think? Nehemiah, God could have used a rock and the same thing would have happened. He didn't have to have Nehemiah. And Nehemiah knows that. So he gave credit, of course, to God. "And the king granted me according to the good hand of my God upon me." How many times do we do things that God wants us to do, and then when we're done with it, we're the ones who are taking credit for it? Yoo-hoo. Man, this is awesome. Aren't I good? Man, I am so good. Point number 5. In the process of thinking through his plan, he knew that any success was going to have to come from God. The success has to come from God. Again, back in verses 2 through 4 of chapter 2. "And the king said to me, 'Why is your face sad, seeing you're not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart.' Then I was very much afraid. I said to the king, 'Let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lieth in ruins, and its gates have been destroyed by fire?' Then the king said to me, 'What are you requesting?'" And what did he do? He again prayed. Remember? So he started off with prayer when he first heard of the problem. The king says, "Why are you sad?" Oh, man. Time to pray. "So I prayed to the God of heaven." So this is the moment that Nehemiah has been praying for, but kind of dreading, you know, where the king says, "Okay, what do you want?" And he knows that God has given him this opportunity. He knows that God is going to win. He knows that God has a plan, but always in our hearts anyway, we're thinking, "Okay, don't let me blow it, Lord. Please, let me be persuasive." God is saying, you know, "Don't worry about that. I got everything covered." No matter how you put it, he's going to say yes. Point number 6. His plan was so detailed that it looks like he even planned the words that he was going to use. The words that he's going to use, he even planned out how he would say it to the king. Nehemiah 2:2-4. "And the king said to me, 'Why is your face sad, seeing you're not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart.' And I was very much afraid. And I said to the king, 'Let the king live forever.'" And he doesn't say, "Let me go back to Jerusalem, to the Jews, and go and rebuild Jerusalem." No. He says, "Why should not my face be sad when the city," he doesn't name the city, "the place of my father's graves," Persians worshiped their ancestors. Okay, this is that oriental idea, like the Chinese, like the Japanese. They worship their ancestors. And when a Persian hears that somebody's graves are being desecrated, that's one of the worst things that can happen. So he doesn't say, "Yeah, I'd like to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild it." He says, "Wouldn't you be sad if the city where your father's graves is lying in ruins, and the gates are destroyed by fire, and this king is going, 'Oh man, I would never stand for that.'" Then the king said to me, "What do you want? I'll give it to you." Now, Nehemiah is very careful to refrain from saying some things, and he's careful in saying some things, and careful to refrain from saying some things. people who are good leaders tend to know when it's time to keep their mouth shut about things. I am still learning that, as Jonna knows. And I'll talk more about that in a minute. So he's careful about how he picks his word. What does he not say? He doesn't use the word Jews. He doesn't use the word Israelites. He doesn't use the word Jerusalem at all. At least until a little later when the king is sympathetic. Well, why doesn't he? Well, it's kind of complicated. It's kind of complicated, but Persian kings, you know, ever since, well, even before they went and conquered Jerusalem, they've had a habit of going back and forth in their support of the Jews. And you ask, well, how so? Turn to Ezra chapter 4. I'm going to very quickly go through Ezra chapter 4, chapter 5, and chapter 6. I'm not going to read all the verses in it, but I just want you to see how these Persian kings, their support of the Jews has waxed and waned over time. And Nehemiah knows about this. So here, Ezra, remember it goes Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Job, Psalm, Proverb. Okay. So the synopsis of Ezra chapter 4, verses 1 through 24. And you might want to be, as I'm gabbing here, you might want to look at Ezra chapter 4. Ezra chapter 4. Now here's the synopsis of Ezra chapter 4. The Jews are busy rebuilding the temple that Cyrus said, go in there and build it. Okay? Cyrus said, go build your temple and I'll take care of you. So they're busy building it. But the kingdoms around them aren't too happy about it. And by the way, who is the kingdom that is the least happy about it? Actually, it's a kingdom of people called the Samaritans. Does anybody know anything about Samaria, the Samaritans?
People stayed away from them.
They didn't like them.
Yeah.
They did. The Jews did not like the Samaritans. The Samaritans didn't like the Jews. Why not? Well, roughly speaking, it's kind of like the relationship historically between Russia and the United States. We don't trust them, they don't trust us. So we don't have a whole lot of dealings with them. At every turn, they're always trying to trip us up. You know, well, this was the Samaritans. And this is where kind of it started, their hatred for the Samaritans. And that's why when Christ, when he's on earth, is talking about the Samaritan, or this guy who fell upon thieves, and a Samaritan comes by and helps him. You know, and then this Russian comes by and helps him, and people are amazed by Christ's story. But anyway, these are the Samaritans. They're not too happy about it. And now the Samaritans tried plan A. In verse 2 of chapter 4 of Ezra, they approached Zerubbabel, he's the one who is in charge of building the temple, and the heads of the fathers' houses, and said to them, let us build with you, for we worship your God as you do, and we've been sacrificing to him ever since the days of whatever, I can't pronounce it, the king of Assyria, who brought us here. So they tried plan A. Hey, let us help you build, because their idea is, if we get into the process, we can be like a bureaucrat and slow this thing down to nothing. We'll stop the building. Well, the Jews knew that these guys are lying to them through their teeth, Zerubbabel. But Zerubbabel, Jeshua, and the other heads of the fathers' houses in Israel said to them, you have nothing to do with us in building the house to our God. We alone will build this house to the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded us to build it. So they said, hit the road. Well, the Samaritans, they still wanted to get this thing stopped, so they went to plan B. Let's contact the new king and let's lie to him and tell him that these people are, once they get this built, we know what's going to happen. Once they get this thing built, they're going to stop paying tribute to you. They're going to be rebellious, because if you look back in your history book, the relationship between the Jews and these Persians has not been real good. So I'm just telling you. Then the people of Israel of the land discouraged the people of Judah and made them afraid to build. And they bribed counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So Darius came up. And in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. And then here it goes on in verse 7, 8, 9, and 10. Well, in the beginning in verse 11 of Ezra 4, and the Quote, this is a copy of the letter they sent to Artaxerxes, the king. Your servants, the men of the province beyond the river, send greeting. And now, be it known to the king that the Jews who came up to you, came up from you to us, have gone to Jerusalem. They are rebuilding that rebellious and wicked city. They're finishing the walls and repairing the foundations. Now be it known to the king that if this city is rebuilt and the walls are finished, they'll not pay tribute, custom, or toll, and the royal revenue will be impaired. You're going to lose some money here. Now, because we eat the salt of the palace, and it is not fitting for us to witness the king's dishonor, so we're just kind of letting you know that these people are doing this. In order that search may be made in the book of the records of your fathers, you'll find in the book of the records and learn that this city is a rebellious city, hurtful to kings and provinces, and that sedition was stirred up in it from old. That is why this city was laid waste. So here, now they're writing, we want to be part of the rebuilding. Now, hit the road. Fine. They write letters to the king and say, you got to stop this. So the king fell for their lies, as you see in verse 17. King fell for their lies and said, okay, all work has to stop. Well, the Jews said, no, King Cyrus told us to build it, and we're doing it. And so they continued building. So if you look in chapter 5 of Ezra, again, this is the Reader's Digest version of what's going on. Why am I saying all this? Because Nehemiah chose his words carefully because the kings kept going back and forth. So in Ezra chapter 5, the Jews figured the king wasn't aware, this king, Ahasuerus, wasn't aware of King Cyrus's earlier decree. So Zerubbabel says to everybody, get back to work. So they get back to work. Now, one of the local leaders, one of those Samaritans, comes up to them and says, hey, who gave you the authority to build? And by the way, we want to know the names, write them down, of all the people who are in charge here, and we're going to send that to the king. Well, the Jews, that's in verse 3 and 4. And in beginning in verse 5 of Ezra 5, the Jews weren't intimidated at all, and they kept on working. Meanwhile, the Samaritans sent another letter to the king and said, the Jews are still building. And in fact, you wouldn't believe it. The Jews are telling us some kind of a weird story. Can you believe it? That your grandfather, Cyrus, you know, king, not physical grandfather, but the king two kings back, said, yeah, go back and rebuild that temple and I'll even pay for it. Can you believe they're telling us these lies? So they write a letter about that. So what does the king do? The king says, wow, this is weird. Let's search the records. Let's search the records. So the plan backfires, and the king looks in the records, and in Ezra chapter 6, go to Ezra chapter 6, and it tells of how the search was made in the house of archives where the documents were stored, and it says in the record, in verse 3, in the first year of Cyrus the king issued a decree concerning the house of God at Jerusalem. Let the house be rebuilt, the place where sacrifices were offered, and let its foundations be retained. Its height shall be 60 cubits, and its breadth 60 cubits. And with 3 layers of great stones and 1 layer of timber, let the cost be paid from the royal treasury. And also let the gold and silver vessels of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took out of the temple that's in Jerusalem and brought to Babylon, be restored and brought back to the temple that's in Jerusalem, each to its place. You shall put them in the house of God. Oh, man. So the king is looking at this and said, wow, Cyrus really did make that decree. The Jews weren't lying to the Samaritans. Now, therefore, Tatnai, the governor of the province of the area beyond the river, Tatnai was the head of the Samaritans, Tatnai, governor of the province beyond the river, I can't pronounce the name, Shethar-Bozenai, and your associates, the governors, this is a letter going out to this governor from the king, in verse 7, Ezra chapter 6, let the work on this house of God alone, leave him alone, let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews rebuild this house of God on its site. Moreover, I make a decree regarding what you shall do for the elders of these Jews for the rebuilding of this house of God. The cost is to be paid to these men in full and without delay from the royal revenue, the tribute of the province from beyond the river. You're going to pay for it. And here these guys are going, wow, this thing backfired on us. And whatever is needed, bulls, rams, sheep for burnt offerings to the God of heaven, wheat, salt, wine, or oil, as the priests at Jerusalem require, let that be given to them day by day. You're going to give it to them without fail, that they may offer pleasing sacrifices to the God of heaven and pray for the life of the king and his sons. And then in verse 11, catch this. And if you don't, I'm going to kill you, the king says to the Samaritans. Verse 11, also I make a decree that if anyone alters this edict, a beam shall be pulled out of his house, and he shall be impaled on it, and his house shall be made a dunghill. May the God who has caused his name to dwell there overthrow any king or people who shall put out a hand to alter this, or to destroy the house of God that is in Jerusalem. I, Darius, make a decree. Let it be done with all diligence. Then in verse 13, chapter 6 of Ezra, then according to the word sent by Darius the king, Tatnai the governor of the province beyond the river, Shareth Bozani and their associates did with all diligence what Darius the king called them to do. So isn't it amazing how God works? But Nehemiah knew that these kings can be kind of capricious. And so that King Cyrus was fine with it. But then everybody kind of forgot about it, and accusations are made. They had to go back and search in the records. Did this thing really happen? Sure enough, it did. So then, thankfully, God worked in the heart of Darius to say, no, this work is going to continue. So back to Nehemiah. He knew that kings can change their minds, and they can get away with it because they're the king. So he was careful not to say some things, and he was careful to say other things. So let's go back to Nehemiah chapter 2. So what did he say, and what did he not say? So Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 3, I said to the king, let the king live forever. Of course, he's respectful to his authority. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins? Its gates have been destroyed by fire. So he was speaking to the king of this nation who's revered, and this king is revered, and this king is worshipped, and this king is head of a land that worships their ancestors. Okay? Now, he was wise in picking certain words, but he was wise in what he didn't say. Here's some words of wisdom from Proverbs, things that we ought to memorize. I need to live by them more. Proverbs 10:19. When words are many, transgression is not lacking, but whoever restrains his lips is prudent. Sometimes it's best just to keep your mouth shut. Why don't I, Al Carper, learn that? I don't know. Proverbs 17:28. You know, it's kind of like, you know, the guy having a conversation with his wife and he just won't shut up about something. That person is standing behind the guy going, stop, don't talk like that. But we keep talking. Proverbs 17:28. Even a fool who keeps silent is considered wise. When he closes his lips, he's deemed intelligent. Just keep your mouth shut. Proverbs 29:11, a fool gives full vent to his spirit. You get angry about something, upset about something, I tend to do this, and we just say what we want to say. Sometimes it's best just to keep the mouth shut. A fool gives full vent to his spirit, but a wise man quietly holds it back. He was a planner. Second, he was a preparer. He was a preparer. Now, people who are wise leaders prepare for the future. One of the things, I'm a teacher. John is a teacher. One of the things that drives me absolutely bonkers is when my students, I give them opportunities to stand before the group and give presentations. When they get up to prepare to do something and you realize these people aren't prepared at all. Jonah does something called, I don't even know what they're called, project where they have to show equipment or something like that. What's that? ITPs, individual teaching presentations. Me, I have them do something on a business topic. Well, they'll get up there, they'll hook their computer up to the data projector, and it should be going on, but nothing is working right. And I will, from the back, I'll say, by the way, when did you come in and practice it? Well, we didn't. We just assumed everything would be okay. No. Leaders don't assume that everything is going to be okay. Leaders prepare, okay? Leaders get things done ahead of time so that they know that stuff will be there. Now, in verses, Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 9 through 16. I won't read the whole thing. I'll just go verse by verse. Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 9. Then I came to the governors of the provinces beyond the river, and I gave them the king's letters, the ones that he had asked for. Now the king had sent with me officers of the army and horsemen. Why? Well, you know, Scripture says that God will give you exceedingly abundantly above all that you can ask or think. Well, he was asking for wood. He was asking for letters of protection, but the king, but God honored him even more than that. The king said, well, you need to have some soldiers go along with you, because when you're out in the Wild West, you're just kind of on your own. So I'm going to send a contingent of soldiers with you to kind of guard you and make sure that you're okay. So he gave him a military escort. They provided protection. It was also a symbol. I mean, when you're traveling and you've got the king's best beside you, and the people beyond the river look at him and go, whoa, I guess the king really does like this guy and really wants this to happen. So it was a symbol of the king's permission. And it was a visual image that the king was behind this 100%. As opposed to some guy who's coming just with a letter. The king says, I'm supposed to do this. Yeah, whatever. But when somebody shows up with a whole cadre of officers and soldiers, and he says, here, the king says, give me all the wood I want. How soon do you need it? Verse 10, but when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite, we'll talk more about them in future chapters, the servants heard this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. So I went to Jerusalem, and I was there 3 days. Then I arose in the night. So he's there in Jerusalem. He goes with all these soldiers, and he goes and he beds down in Jerusalem. Now, there's not a whole lot there. You know, it's just rubble. Gates burned with fire. The walls are all broken down. And he's there for 3 days. He doesn't say much about anything. It's just, you know, this whole group comes in and they're wondering, who is this guy? Why are these people here? And he doesn't say anything. So he just goes there. I was in Jerusalem for 3 days. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. And I told no one what God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. There was no animal with me but the one on which I rode. I went out by night by the valley gate to the dragon spring and to the dung gate, and I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that were broken down and its gates that had been destroyed by fire. So he gets up in the night, and he's riding. He's got this donkey with him, the thing that he was riding on. And a few people who he said, by the way, let's go out. We're going to have a little reconnaissance mission tonight. So they go out, and he's doing an inspection tour at night. Then I rode on, this is verse 14, to the fountain gate and to the king's pool. But there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. There's so much rubble there. Then I went up in the night by the valley and inspected the wall. And I turned back and entered by the valley gate and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone. You know, those the enemy? They didn't know where I had gone or what I was doing. And I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were to do the work. He's presuming something here. All these people are going to do the work, and they're going to be working for me, and they don't even know it yet. I haven't told anybody. So being a preparer, point number one. Preparing for the job that God has for you begins long before you're called to do the job. Now, one of the things, now I know my time is escaping me very quickly here. One of the things that drives me crazy, and you said it and I said it when we were in high school, how will I ever use this in life, you say to your math teacher or whatever. People who are leaders never ask that question, because what you're doing is they know that I'm picking a little bit up here and I'm putting in my toolbox. I'm picking it up there. I'm putting in my toolbox. I mean, imagine you're in a ship. That ship crashes on the shore of a desert island. The tide is coming in and will very soon take that ship out. What are you going to do? You're going to get every possible thing you can use out of that ship. You're going to grab something. And you're going to say, do you say, oh, how will I ever use this? No, I'll never use that. And you throw it out. You grab everything. Well, leaders do that. They grab everything. They grab every experience they can have. If you have an opportunity to learn how to build something, you do. If you have an opportunity to go to an opera, you do. Because, well, the Lord may somehow use that. So he was a listener. He absorbed things all of his life. He knew what areas in the kingdom were solidly held by the king and which were more dangerous. Hence, he asked for the letters. Show me a person who doesn't care anything about learning anything outside of their little narrow scope of what they do, and I'll show you somebody who is not a leader. They are just, you know, a time card puncher. That's all they're doing. I'll put the, you know, third lug nut on the front right wheel, and that's all I care to do in life. These people aren't going to be leading anybody. And I don't mean great leader. I'm talking about leading friends, leading family. These are people who, they learn everything they possibly can. They're like sponges who soak everything up. Okay. Point number two, preparing a job begins quietly by checking out the situation. Nehemiah was there for 3 days and didn't say a word. Can you imagine the speculation that was going on? I don't know. Can you imagine the speculation that was going on here? Here's a guy for 3 days, and he comes with these Persian troops, you know, and he's got the backing of the king. Something is going on, and he's not saying a word. You know, he's accompanied by these king soldiers. What's he up to? And he doesn't say a thing. People are starting to get uneasy about it. Usually nothing good comes from people with clipboards when they come into your office, okay? Scripture doesn't indicate what he did during those 3 days. He wasn't wasting his time, I'm sure. He was under a time constraint because he told the king when he would be back. You know, in verse 6 of chapter 2, when will you be back? And he gave him a time. So my guess, I'm just speculating here, he was using that time to check out the people. Who are the leaders? Who are the followers? What are the formal groups, the informal groups? How strong are they? Maybe he's waiting for the moon to get brighter so he can check out the stuff at night. So the application, leaders don't jump to change things. They spend some time gathering information. Now, he's going to look at the resources, and I'm going to talk about the resources next time because my time is up. So I'm going to have to stop there. So next time we'll get together. When are we going to get together? Is it 2 weeks from now? 3 weeks from now?
I don't know. I forget the date.
Okay. But I'm really looking forward to it. So hopefully we've seen some things that leaders do and that the Lord might use us as leaders. Let's go ahead and close in prayer.
We pray that we have been a blessing to you. For further assistance, call us at 864-270-1472 anytime. Send email to info@stlmm.org or visit our website at www.stlmm.org. Like any ministry, it costs money to operate. Please consider supporting this ministry as God leads you with your prayers and your financial gifts by going to www.stlmm.org and clicking on donations.